Well, good morning, everyone. When Simon invited me to speak, he particularly said he wanted me to preach on this particular topic this morning. And I looked at the brief that he'd given me, and it seemed to all be about very old people. And I know I'm sort of on the older end of people in the church, but I kind of thought, well, that's a bit much. But actually, then I realised I'd got the wrong passage. That's actually the passage that Rachel Riddle actually opened our Advent season on a couple of weeks ago. I'm watching and waiting, if you remember that. So I looked at the brief that Simon had given me for this passage, and what it said was, Joseph was in a bit of a predicament. His fiancée was pregnant, and he was not the father. And I'm still not sure why Simon thought this was particularly relevant for me to speak upon. It's supposed to be on trusting and daring, and maybe it was the trusting element, I don't know. But it's Christmas Eve, and these are familiar passages, and I'm kind of wondering what new I can say about them. So I'm going to attempt to be entertaining, which is not really a requirement for a sermon, enlightening, which might be a better reason, and also hopefully encouraging, and also try and be expeditious. And I will try and get back to the topic as well. So let's have a look at the passage, if you've got it, which is at the start of Matthew's Gospel proper. Or is it? Because immediately before this, of course, you get one of those, what we usually regard as one of those rather annoying genealogies. And it's very tempting to gloss over these, and it is actually a style of literature which crops up in the Bible and in ancient times in other cultures quite a lot. It just looks like a list of vaguely familiar Old Testament names to us, probably, and doesn't necessarily mean much. But it clearly did mean something to Matthew, who included it here. And very unusually, five women feature in this list, which would have been unheard of in Jewish culture. So only the men would have counted. Apologies to the ladies. By the way, there's also a genealogy in Luke's Gospel as well, in chapter 3. And it's different from Matthew's, but don't worry. Luke gives the genealogy according to Mary's line, not according to Joseph's line, until you get back to King David. And it turns out that Jesus was actually the son of David through both his parents' lines. Anyway, coming back to these women that we have listed here, amongst all these male patriarchs and kings and prophets, we have a woman who disguised herself as a temple prostitute so that she could seduce her father-in-law to get pregnant by him. That was Tamar. A foreign prostitute who betrayed her own people. That was Rahab. An immigrant from a despised enemy nation. That was Ruth, the Moabite. And an adulteress who's not actually named, Bathsheba. That's assuming some measure of complicity with David's seduction of her. And then finally we have Mary. And I don't know what image you have of Mary from the Christmas story. And I suggest we usually think of her as devout, pious, saintly, perhaps particularly by the image on the left-hand side here. Lots of history and culture with that. And yet, she's going to be in the same line as these other women. She's going to have to live with questions about her reputation and morality, perhaps. How did she get pregnant before she was married? So they could be considered a somewhat mixed bag of people, not the obvious candidates to put in a genealogical list if you want to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, particularly if you want to appeal to a Jewish audience or even a male audience. Having said that, the men in this list aren't a lot better either, are they? If we start off with Abraham, who passed his wife off as his sister to the king of Egypt to protect his own life. We have Isaac, who favoured one son over the other. And we have Jacob, whose name means deceiver and liar, who deceived his brother and his uncle and just about everybody else he came across. And between the three of them, they probably started 4,000 years of pretty much continuous conflict in the Middle East. And that's just the first three of them. So what's Matthew trying to communicate by including them all in this list, particularly the women perhaps? Even though Matthew's gospel is kind of like the Jewish gospel, it's surprisingly orientated towards Gentiles, towards non-Jews. Interesting, isn't it, that Matthew's gospel is the one that has the wise men from the East and the Roman puppet king And Luke's gospel, which is the more Gentile-orientated gospel, is the one that has the local shepherds and the prophecies in the temple with Simeon and Anna. Anyway, I think what Matthew's trying to say here is he's trying to show that the gospel includes everybody. And he's also showing that God is not particularly fussy about reputation or about history. Whatever the failures or sins of the past, whatever reputation or label that we've either inherited or had to live with or grow up with, Matthew's showing us by this rather obscure to us list of names that everyone is welcome in the kingdom of God, as long as we recognise the baby Jesus as our king. Okay, let's move on to the passage proper, looking at verses 18 and 19. Now, we don't have time to go into exactly what it means to be betrothed or pledged in Jewish culture. We understand that it's more than an engagement, but it's not a marriage, even though Joseph is referred to as Mary's husband in verse 19. And because of the situation they're in, Joseph is a righteous man, he's a God-fearing man, he has in mind to divorce Mary quietly, to sort of put her aside. We can see immediately his good qualities. He's a man of grace, he's not malicious, he's thinking of her as well. And I think we need to think into the kind of small rural community that they grew up in, and which actually probably for thousands of years many people have lived in, where you know everybody in the village that you live in, and probably the surrounding half a dozen villages. And if you're disgraced in that community, or if there's questions about your moral character, everybody effectively in your entire universe knows about it. We probably forget about this in the sort of period since the sexual revolution of the 1960s. But as I say, that's probably been the case for many people down the centuries, and maybe still is the case for quite a lot of people in different parts of the world. So I think this might have been a real challenge for Joseph and Mary, being a God-fearing man, the kind of reputational damage that was going to happen with this, that might have been the worst thing for him to live with, actually. Interestingly, Psalm 62 says, "My salvation and my honour depend on God. He is my rock and mighty refuge." And I've highlighted the "my honour." Interesting that this challenge is going to come to them from God, actually. Question marks about them. And so this puts another fly in the ointment, perhaps, in terms of God's plan of salvation. If you think about the birth of Jesus, it could have come unstuck for a number of reasons. Mary could actually have been stoned for adultery before Jesus was born. That would have been within the law, and if you remember, it's what the Pharisees tried to get Jesus to approve of in John chapter 8. Herod might have succeeded in killing Jesus as a baby in Bethlehem. The family might have got lost in Egypt as immigrants, perhaps trapped and destitute and unable or perhaps unwilling to return to Israel. But there was another potential threat, not from a zealous application of the law of Moses, or from an evil despot, or from circumstances that would challenge anybody. Because Joseph was a righteous man, his very God-fearing nature, if you like, could have undone God's plan as well. And I think that's why he needed an angelic visitation. Now, let's not get distracted by angelic visitations and dreams too much. God, I think, speaks to people in different ways, at different times, and to different people, probably in the way that they're most receptive to him. And dreams obviously work for Joseph and for the Magi, four times for Joseph and once for the Magi in these two chapters. Now, a few of you will know that I'm a student of naval history, and I'm going to show you, hopefully, a plan of a famous battleship, which I'm sure a good number of you will actually have heard of. Any suggestions? Other than Pennant, who I happen to know was looking at the slides when Nal was running through them at the start. Any ideas? No? Okay, it's HMS Dreadnought. And it reset the standard for design of battleships that followed. So that collectively, everything that was built afterwards was called a dreadnought, and everything that was built before it was called a pre-dreadnought. It is literally the AD and the BC of battleship design. And it was designed by Admiral Jackie Fisher, there's hopefully a picture of him, who's probably the most significant admiral in the British Navy after Nelson. And he was a devout man too. So much so that he would attend church services two or three times a day when he was ashore, just to go and listen to the sermons. I don't know what the poor preacher thought when the senior admiral turned up to discourse with him on his sermon afterwards. And he specifically named this particular dreadnought, because there were other dreadnoughts in the Navy before this, after a verse in Deuteronomy. And I'll have to give it to you in the King James Version that Fisher would have used, of course. And this is Moses reminding the Israelites that God is with them. And it says in Deuteronomy 1, verse 29, "Then I said unto you, dread naught, neither be afraid of them." So, whenever you hear mention of dreadnoughts or battleships, particularly dreadnoughts, remember it's actually a verse of encouragement from the Old Testament. Anyway, so what, you might well say. That's all very interesting, but we're not here for a lecture on naval history, unfortunately. But have you noticed that every time an angel appears in the New Testament with a message for somebody, the first thing they have to say is, dread naught, or fear not, or do not be afraid. To Zechariah in the temple, to Mary at the Annunciation, to the shepherds in the fields, and after the resurrection, actually, to the women in the garden, from which I think we can probably conclude that angels are fairly frightening beings to us mere mortals, perhaps not the image that people try to sometimes convey. Interestingly, I think people in the Old Testament were a bit more credulous where angels were concerned. And Joseph too gets a fear not, but in more measured tones in verse 20. He says, the angel says to him, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife. And the reason I think for this is that Joseph is a righteous man. He needs this special message of assurance that marrying Mary is going to be the right thing under these circumstances. He needs that direct word from God, because they're both going to have to live with questions and doubts from their neighbours for the next 20 or 30 years until Jesus' ministry starts, and obviously the things which have happened will be fulfilled and obvious. Now, did you notice that the angel also gives Joseph three instructions? He says, marry Mary, take her home, name the baby Jesus. So this isn't just a marriage in name only. He's not, okay, I'll marry Mary, it'll just be a legal marriage and I'll just put us quietly somewhere else. He has to take her into his family home. And that might, of course, brought possibly some shame on his parents too, I don't know. Clearly there's no hiding from Mary, she's the one having the baby. So I think, as John Aitken said last week actually about Joseph, we should really be staggered by Joseph's trust and obedience, and Mary's too. God chose these two servants extremely well. This ordinary couple clearly had extraordinary faith, as Simon was telling us a couple of weeks ago, because they obediently accepted a massive challenge, the burden that God placed on their lives. And of course, it didn't just end with an unexpected pregnancy or an unexpected journey. No fun that, I guess, if 80 miles on a donkey from Nazareth to Jerusalem when you're 8 3/4 months pregnant. After this, there will be other challenges too. And an angel appears to Joseph three more times for things that Joseph is going to need to know. So the second thing is to flee Herod's persecution and to escape to Egypt, where apparently there was actually quite a large Jewish community at that time. But not the obvious place for Jews to escape to, the former land of slavery. And then also to return to Israel after Herod was dead. And then finally to return to Nazareth rather than Bethlehem. And that last one seems a bit odd, doesn't it? Did Joseph make a mistake going back to Bethlehem? Was he kind of out of touch with God's direction at that point? Well, I think probably not. And this is only a suggestion from myself, so don't read too much more into that. But I think Joseph was probably thinking, Jesus is in the line of David. I should go back to the city of David, Bethlehem, to fulfill the prophecy and the expectation of that. And that's why I think he needed this extra direction to go back to Nazareth, to fulfill a less well-known prophecy, probably not the place he would have preferred to go back to, where he and Mary would have been known. Bethlehem might have been better. I don't know. Jack Deere says in his book, Surprised by the Voice of God, people only hear the audible voice of God, or receive messages through special means, dreams, visions, angels, if you like, if God is asking them to do something really special and really difficult. Because they're going to need to hold on to that reassurance to keep going with that, if that's the right thing. And that's why I think Joseph had four messages from angels in dreams, because he had to do quite specific things. Two of them could have been rather at variance with God's law, the first and the last. The second one needed immediate action, flee to Egypt. And the third one, he needed reassurance that he wasn't putting the family back in danger by doing that. So Joseph is faithful and trusting in all of those things. To marry Mary when she's pregnant and he's not responsible, to abandon friends and family, flee to Egypt, to return to Israel when there might still be danger, and more specifically to go to Nazareth to fulfill a lesser prophecy. And before I finish, I'd just like to reflect on some aspects of the Christmas story, which you've probably thought about as well. But we're at the end of the Advent season, and I thought it might be quite good to do that. And these hopefully are comforting messages, although perhaps not for us in the comfortable West, a bit over familiar with these stories. But God brought Jesus into the world in a very specific way, and lots of people can identify, I think, with this. So for refugees fleeing very real persecution at the moment and harm from their own countries, living in exile in refugee camps all across the Middle East, in Africa, in Bangladesh and elsewhere, I'm sure. For immigrants who are trying to make the best of it in a foreign country. For those wondering when it's safe to go home, whether it's to a country, a town, or even a house. For those who have to make long journeys with young families or give up family ties and friends, making a fresh start. For those who might have to live with doubts and sneers about their integrity, especially when they're guiltless in a small community that they can't escape from. And for those who've had to take on responsibilities that were never asked for. I don't know, I'm not in any of those circumstances, but I hope that provides some comfort for people who are in those situations when they hear of the Christmas story, perhaps particularly if they've come across it for the first time. Well, this talk was supposed to be about trusting and daring, and certainly we've had plenty of that from Joseph and Mary. They obviously had great faith, they trusted in God, they were obedient, they were given a kind of special dispensation, if you like. But the truth of the matter is, that most of what God needs to say to us, he's already said to us in the life of Jesus, in his words, and of course, in what he said through this as well. We don't need to pray for the Bible. It's all there and intact. But sometimes God will specifically call us to other things. I confess I couldn't think of any really good examples from my own Christian life. I do have some from my professional life, where I've dared and trusted it was the right thing to do. Notably in starting my own business, which I wouldn't particularly recommend, but it's going quite well in some respects. Not because I was called by God, but it seemed to make sense at the time. And I could easily have persuaded myself it was too risky and ducked the opportunity. And I've even given some talks to university students about being an entrepreneur in science, which my wife thinks is a bit of a joke, because she thinks I'm about the most un-entrepreneurial person she knows, which is a bit harsh. But there is a large element of truth in that, I would have to confess. However, I'm not as bad as the entire French nation, according to George Bush, in a quote that probably isn't true, but it sounds true, and I think that's why it comes at the top of the list of quotes that you get from George Bush. But to return to trusting in God, most of what he wants us to trust him for, as I say, he's already told us quite plainly. You know, if he's going to call us to do something daring, he's going to let us know in quite specific terms and reassuring terms. So I would say, be careful what you pray for. A well-known Christian book is entitled, If You Want to Walk on Water, You Have to Get Out of the Boat, which I confess I haven't read, partly because it doesn't really appeal to me, in the sense that I don't think you really need to walk on water in the normal Christian life. I can borrow the title of another famous Christian book, which I have read. There are other means for crossing water. But I get what the author means. You know, if you want to walk on water, if you want or need to walk on water, you've got to take that first small step of doing that. Or as Hemingway has said, the best way to find out if you can trust somebody is to trust them. So my practical advice this morning is really quite simple and short. God won't be found lacking if we trust him. I think the limitations are all going to be on our side. And I suspect if we trust God more, we will prove him to be trustworthy. And if we dare to trust him more, then we'll see God do greater things in our lives. So as we conclude this Advent season, let's fear not, but have faith to trust in God, to dare to see what he might do in our lives and indeed through us as we go into 2018. Amen.